Hello and welcome to another SPAC Insider podcast, where we bring an independent eye in interviewing the targets of SPAC transactions and their SPAC partners. SPAC deals have provided a variety of ways to try and ride the growth in the private aviation space. One of the most successful so far has been to approach it not through the aircraft or sales of flights, but as an infrastructure play. I'm Nick Clayton, and this week I speak with Francisco Gonzalez, CFO of private hangar operator Sky Harbor. Francisco explains why he believes Sky Harbor has traded consistently up from its valuation in its $777 million combination with Yellowstone 2 years ago. Why are hangars such a high-demand and profitable part of the aviation space? And how has Sky Harbor gained investor confidence in its plans yet to come, while much of the industry still faces skepticism? Take a listen. So just to start off, Francisco, you know, Sky Harbor has announced some new developments and a new COO recently. You know, what's been new with the company and how has the beginning of the year been for you?
We've been very busy in rolling out our profitable growth model, which involves the signing of ground leases at key business aviation airports in the U.S. and then developing hangars for business aircraft to home base. So we signed, in general, 50-year ground leases, develop the hangars. It probably takes us about 18 months to do that. And then we lease them to tenants, you know, people who own private aircrafts. They could tend to be individuals, corporate fleets, you know, people who run charter operations and so on. And we lease those in 3, 5, 7, and sometimes 10 years. And we are right now operational in 3 airports, Nashville, Miami, and Houston. And then we are in development and construction in Phoenix, Denver, and Dallas. And then we recently announced new ground leases in Chicago, Poughkeepsie, New York, and Bradley International in Hartford, Connecticut. And we had told the market that we'll be announcing 3 more at the beginning part of this year. So everything's tracking according to our, you know, original business plan. And again, happy to share what the SPAC aspects of our funding had to do with all this in this podcast.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely interested in getting into that. But I'm interested also just kind of going back to the beginning a little bit. You know, how did Sky Harbor get its start? And what was it sort of seeing out there in the private aviation space as a real need that wasn't being met out there?
Yes, thank you for the question. So our founder, Tal Kanen, is, you know, former Air Force pilot who moved back to Manhattan. He bought a plane and he was looking for a hangar himself. This is back in 2017, 18. And he ended up in Montauk, New York, basically, you know, with traffic almost four hours away at the tip of Long Island. So then he quickly realized, oh my gosh, this is not just a New York area problem. It's a major metropolitan area problem all over the U.S. Deficit of hangars at airports for business aviation, a lot of pent-up demand, not enough supply. It takes time to develop these hangars. And this is obviously pre-COVID. So that was the genesis of Sky Harbor. COVID has just accelerated the trend of people trying to avoid commercial aviation. You know how it is if you try to get a commercial airport, going through the long lines, the security, the delays, you know, the strikes, you name it, there's a problem. So the it's been booming in the private aircraft world. And obviously in all these planes, private planes, who, you know, there's like 2 years of backlog over at the manufacturers, they all need a home. And that's what we're looking to fill the need for hangar space for home basing of private aviations in the U.S.
Great. And what was the point where the company really felt like it was a good time to go public and, you know, and the public markets were going to open up some opportunities for it? And how did Yellowstone first kind of come onto the scene in those conversations?
Yeah, thanks for the question. You know, I'm a banker by training. I spent 25 years in the street. And I think even though I did some IPOs in my, you know, younger days, I basically advise everybody not to go public. You know, going public is not, should not be an end on itself. It should be something that makes sense for any particular company at the right time of their cycle or their life and so on. And, you know, we are early stage and we're also very infrastructure real estate heavy. Things that not necessarily go hand in hand with being a public company. And, you know, we are in a very, you know, I don't want to call it boring, but a very kind of like, you know, a bricks and mortar, steel and concrete type of infrastructure. We're not, you know, you look at the universe of these SPAC companies out there, they're all trying to find the latest invention in electric aviation or electric cars, or finding the new medicine, the new cure-all, or I'm exaggerating to make a point, or software companies doing things. So there are a lot of hockey stick option type business plans out there that got de-SPAC'd. And we are really very much very steady state, a very visible, profitable business model. Real estate, so very traditional, if I can put it that way. So when we were approached by Yellowstone to take us public, my initial reaction was to say no, to pass on that. And the sponsor of Yellowstone is a company called Boston Omaha, also publicly listed. Great individuals, great track record. And they very much believed in our business model, and they supported it by also participating in the de-SPACing in a meaningful way. So even though the SPAC market was already kind of like having its problems in terms of, especially for the de-SPAC companies, we ended up embracing the participation by Boston Omaha and Yellowstone in our business. And then we went ahead and de-SPAC'd. One anecdote that people might not have looked at in this whole drama is that we de-SPAC and closed on the very last day that we had before, some of all these SPACs have a shelf life. If you don't de-SPAC on a particular date, unless you extend, you get basically forced to return the money to the SPAC investors. And we had no time to spare it because, it takes time to do a proper de-SPAC, the SEC filings, the audited financials, all that. And we were successful in doing that on the very last day possible. This is in January 24, 25th. So again, 2 years and a few months ago. And it has been great. All the concerns that I had about being a public company, cost, the having to handle investors, the quarterly reporting. Yes, we have gone through all of that, but it has been, I got to say, less burdensome than I originally expected. And if anything, being a public company has given us an audience. It's almost like we are in a constant roadshow, because all the time we get people reaching out to us, interested in our product or interested in investing in us. It's just been very interesting experience. So no regrets. We'll do it all over again.
Yeah. I mean, I imagine it's been a really interesting ride, because as you mentioned, you got to the definitive agreement and were able to announce it in December 2021, which was, at the end of 2021 was kind of the heyday of SPACs, but already probably by that time, some of the macro and environmental factors were starting to turn a little bit against SPACs. And I'm just curious, as you were going through then close, changed some of the terms of the deal, worked with some of the financing. Were you starting to sense the environment changing around you, just in sort of the market broadly as you were working through that? And I guess it's, what was it like sort of having to kind of work on some things as you were sort of spinning all the plates at once there?
Yes. Let me start with answering your question and then give some color about the process. So yes, by time we, usually you do a pipe before you de-SPAC. And, when we're in the pipe roadshow, which basically you're almost doing a pipe, but also, sitting down with the investors in the SPAC to see if they're going to stay, correct? But you, to your point, back in the fall, winter of 22, the SPAC market had basically cratered. So we will go to these meetings and the SPAC investors will tell us, hey, before you even start, let me tell you we're redeeming. And we're like, but how could you tell us? We haven't even told you what our story is about. I'm sure all SPAC investors listening to this, they know that, for some, it's about being able to get, back then what was a healthy interest on their cash, and then the ability to have the quote unquote free warrant, even if they redeemed. So there were things at play here in the SPAC market that lend themselves to people, participating in SPACs, even though they had no intentions, whatever the story was, to stay in. At the end of the day, from our perspective, again, we're happy and pleased that we're able to de-SPAC. I think one of the critical factors of being prepared, because we were an early stage company and because we were starting from scratch on many things, we were successful in being ready to de-SPAC. And if I may, I'll say why. First, we needed to create audited financials to our company. And because we're starting from scratch, we decided to do them PCAOB standards, meaning the highest standards by the accounting board. And that's something you need to go public. Because we had that in place, and also we had been doing bonds, public bonds, prior to de-SPACing, we had, a official statement, a prospectus, a fully diligenced that also allowed us that when the time came and we were approached to go public, it was kind of like relatively easy for us to quickly amass all the information in the way that obviously the market and the SEC needs to be able to complete all the requirements on the documentation side to go public. So that was also, I think, a key success factor from a process perspective in terms of our ability to complete the transaction.
Yeah, and I find that really interesting, especially because, as you mentioned, you had some experience with other financing types, and and being in with kind of an element of construction and what you're doing in terms of your build out, that tends to be kind of a different kind of financing than, say, as you mentioned, some of the SPAC targets that have gone through, generally a venture capital route. And so you got to see a lot of different, I guess, financing types there. And then at close, you had did have a mix of the PIPE, some trust capital, a forward purchase agreement, and you've since done some private placements. I guess just, what has been your what have been the things you've wanted to prioritize in terms of the type of capital you're trying to bring in, and the structure of that finance, and how to move through all of those different options and get forward?
No, very good question. Obviously, as a CFO, I care much and give a lot of thought to capital formation, correct? And we are in the business of doing infrastructure real estate at airports. We're playing the long game, meaning we're building 100-year assets and we're leasing them in 3, 5, 7, 10 years, as I said earlier, to high-quality tenants. And we're trying to grow a geographically diversified, a tenant diversified, and term of lease diversified portfolio of growing cash flows. So when you have that long-term perspective, we need long-term capital. Nothing beats common equity, public common equity as a permanent place of capital. We were approached by private equity funds, but back in our mind, we were saying, well, if we take private equity funds, that means that in 5 or 6 years, they're going to be looking for their liquidity and somehow we have to sell ourselves. And maybe 5 years might not be enough for us to have our kind of like, business plan fully developed. So being going public was that type of permanent capital base that attracted us. Then we were also faced with, we want to pair that capital with debt, and we decided to go the bond route. And so we prepared for a bond deal. We closed that a few months before the business combination agreement. But by the time we were doing the bond deal, we knew, I mean, we knew we were in negotiations already to do the de-SPACing. We just have not announced it yet. And that bond deal was also 33-year fixed rate bonds. So we did the bond deal, again, very long-term fixed rate capital, permanent capital, and that has worked with us very well. Then we raised over the past year and a half, everybody and their mother showed up to show us convertible deals, preferred convertible, all this stuff. And we passed and passed on all of that. And we found a group of investors last October, November that were open and interested in investing in us with common equity. And thus, the PIPE that we did in last November, pure common. And it's important to us to raise that type of capital because we, again, pair it with a lot of leverage in the bond market. And, if you have too much structure, too much fixed rate, even though it's subordinated, it kind of like creates noise for your bondholders. So we hit the sweet spot, we believe, on having permanent debt with a 33-year final, 25-year average life, and with permanent common equity as our two key sources of capital to fund our business. And we're going to continue in the future raising both of them as we deploy our business model and our footprint in the US.
Yeah, and it's been impressive what you've been able to pull together, because not only have you been able to arrange those various financing types, but the market has appreciated your stock as well, which is not something you see with every de-SPAC. Particularly, many of the de-SPAC companies similarly have business models where they expect to be kind of fully operationally where they want to be a few years down the road. That's sort of the case with you as well. But what do you think has been the key part of your story and your offering and how you presented yourself to investors that has brought that confidence that we don't, see necessarily super commonly among somewhat earlier companies?
I will say, first of all, the business model that we have presented very transparently to our investor base and to the market is a very profitable business model. So it's a very modular growth, meaning, we do an airport, people have looked at economics, we put out, when we do the bond deals, third-party projections that give people a sense of what it's going to look like. And it's very modular. So people can kind of like project. We have now two equity research analysts covering us, one from B. Riley, the one from Maxim Group. And they've done a great job in terms of kind of like looking at our path in terms of existing operations, new ground leases that have been recently signed. And you can quickly, easily model that out because when people look at our stock and our market cap, by definition, it's not based on the history, limited history of our revenues. It's very much look forward in terms of what's coming because the visibility is very strong. So I think having the right business model, a model that's modular. And by modular, I mean, this is not a binary thing where, oh my God, if we don't invent the nuclear plant and we don't finish it, it doesn't get done, or the bridge that has to be fully built. You understand? Is we could do, like, if we were to stop here and not get more capital, it'll be profitable. We don't hit the wall. There are a lot of people out there, sorry to say, in the SPAC world that have business models that we're burning out of cash and you need to burn out of cash, Amazon or Uber and so on. Those companies have been very successful in burning cash and being able to cash flow positive because the markets where they're supporting them. If you don't have that type of model, you are at the mercy of the cycles and so on and so forth. As Warren Buffett will say, when the water recedes, you know who's wearing a bathing suit. So fortunately, our business model is not that. It's very modular and people can see clearly the path to profitability. Let me stop there. It's a long-worded answer, but I think that the transparency on the business model and spending time with investors, again and again, going through and having two research analysts with our story out there has been very positive.
Yeah, I mean, that's something I kind of wanted to get to as well, because it's interesting. I think frequently Sky Harbor would be grouped in terms of other companies that have gone public in just sort of the private aviation space over the last couple of years, but a lot of those other companies are, trying to do marketplaces for, individual private flights, or they're working on the vehicles themselves, or they're, those various things, which are all very different business models. But I mean, on some level, I think you could look at it as having a similar thesis of the broader growth within the private aviation industry, but you just have a very different jumping off point within that industry by having the hangars where all the planes got to go eventually, one way or the other. I guess how much time have you had to spend kind of educating people on that? I mean, some de-SPACs, it takes them a while to get those analysts, kind of as you're pointing out there. How big of a lift has it been going through that process of getting everyone understanding that you're not inventing something as much as being able to be ready to kind of grab the growth as it goes?
Literally, I mean, it sounds corny, but it's like one investor at a time. We get emails all the time, and obviously, all with public information, we make available, and walk people through. If you look at our 10-K, answer to that question is here or there. We decided to do IR ourselves. So, hey, we might as well just, do it ourselves and not spend too much time having people coordinate. So, you're going to see more and more that we're going to be hitting the conference circuit. That's the right word, circuit. In terms of being out there at conferences to get our story out. But up to now has been one investor at a time. I think a lot of people from Boston, Omaha, who are invested in our sponsor of Yellowstone, obviously were natural people to be interested in our story. And this is an interesting one. It turns out that a lot of family offices of people who use planes immediately understood what we were targeting in terms of our business model because they're users of planes. They're the ones who have to, face a, where do I put my private plane? Gee, why is it that it's Friday? It's 4 o'clock. I just decided to do a last minute trip to Florida. And as I called my pilots, they were like, well, it's going to take a few hours. We're in the back of the community hangar. We had no plan for this and so on. If they have their plane in their home base in one of our hangars, they just drive right into the hangar, get out of the car, and their wheels up very quickly. So we've seen in the pipe, And you saw in the public announcements that some of our investors in that pipe are people who have planes. One of our tenants was public about investing. He experienced the product. He's one of our tenants in Miami and decided to invest in the last pipe. So nothing beats having our customers, use their investment dollars to support our company as well. So that's a great story. And it's fun. We're having a lot of fun. We are participating in as many industry conferences as well at the various airports. We go to all kinds of airport conferences. So again, the word gets out. And right now, there are very few public vehicles to which you can invest in airport infrastructure. Yes, there's a lot of airplane or eVTOLs or charter or some people running small airlines that have gone public, but not really anyone with major, Atlantic and Signature from the FBO side got taken private and so on. So there's very few vehicles, public vehicles, to which to play the infrastructure space except Sky Harbor.
Yeah. And moving to the products a little bit, what do you see as being the key drivers, both of, the attractiveness of your hangars other than their availability in kind of the right airports? But, just aside from that, in terms of the amenities and how are you able to sort of offer that and still make it such a profitable model for yourselves?
Yes. No, thanks for the question. We take demand risk. So we look at an airport or airports in the U.S., and we obviously have mapped out by now all of the U.S. in terms of what we care about. And we target airports where we see pent-up demand for our product. And then our product, besides the speed to wheels up that I mentioned earlier, provides privacy, most importantly, you have your own office space, you have your own garage space inside. We also offer the best fuel price in that airport because we focus on rental income. Yes, we are the ones who serve in most of our campuses, and we fuel our tenants, but we only fuel our tenants. We don't fuel transient aircraft. We're not an FBO. So our staff is there just to take care of our home-based tenants, and you get that personalized treatment and service that only we can offer, given, again, how small we are and so on. And I think at the only day when you're, especially individuals who decide to purchase a 50, 60, 70, 80 million, the prices of the highest business aircrafts have gone almost in that neighborhood, it makes sense that you have it in the right hangar with the right security service and privacy that entails. And that's what we offer our clients. And plus, in addition, if you're still looking at the cost of all of this, the best fuel price in that airport.
Right. And so, moving through your life as now as a public company, as a public de-SPAC, we've seen a lot of de-SPACs launch warrant exchanges, especially towards the end of last year, just because, in many cases, their warrants are trading very cheaply. But, that's always sort of a question of how do you deal with the overhang of the warrants that are out there. And so, I guess, what is your philosophy on the warrants? I mean, do you feel like that's something that would be worth putting capital towards addressing at some point? Are you unconcerned and just going to wait till they're all exercised once you're trading high enough? What's your approach?
Good question. Wrestle with that a lot in the past 2 years. So not answer that I can give you right now in a public setting. As a former banker, let me be candid. I take advice on this topic very skeptically because, if you go to some of my ex-colleagues and you tell them, hey, I'm a private company, they'll tell you, go public. You tell them I'm a public company, oh my God, go private. Okay, I have these warrants. Okay, you have overhang. You got to take them out. And then if you don't have them, hey, you should issue warrant. I mean, you understand. So I'm a little bit of a cynic here. So obviously we pay attention to it, but our warrants require, our public warrants, that the holder exercise them and pay us $11.50 for them. And so I'm very cognizant that our stock price is above there now, and the warrants have a particular life left. So it's something that we continue to monitor, but right now we have no plans to do anything with them at this juncture.
Right. And so, I feel like we've danced around it a little bit in terms of the opportunity in private aviation, more broadly and the things that you're building out to try to capture. Could you, put in some broad terms, what are we looking at in terms of the growth in private aviation, coming out of the pandemic and beyond now?
Listen, the There's two types of growth. You can look at growth as, you know, the number of passengers or takeoffs and private aviation. From our perspective, it's all about, again, hangar demand, hangar supply, and the new planes, newer planes rolling out of the manufacturers, the OEM manufacturers. And they're, as I mentioned earlier, they have like a two-year backlog, and the planes that are rolling out are bigger planes, which one has to look at the established legacy hangar capacity in the US, and they tend to be hangars that where the newer, bigger planes simply don't fit. So we're very conscious of building bigger hangars to supply in the right at the right markets. And as I said at the very beginning, we had announced three new ground leases last year. We said that we're going to do announce three more by this summer. You know, our webcast is likely to be on the week of March 21st. You know, the date is still floating around a little bit, depending on the timing of our 10K. But at that time, with our 10K and our press release and our webcast, we'll be updating the market in terms of the amount of ground leases that are coming and so on. But we are very optimistic in terms of how attractive our product has been to tenants and how, I will say the following. 2 years ago, we will go to airport conferences, almost asking people to, you know, airport directors to, you know, give us an audience. Hey, let us speak to you for 5 minutes in the corridor. Now we email out that we're going to be at a conference. They recognize our name and then give us a sit down for 30 minutes. So the conversation has now changed. Our brand is known in the airport. Airports do know that they have this deficit, and they have been, in some cases, actually reaching out to us proactively to see if we'll evaluate their airport as a place that we could do a Sky Harbor campus. So we're very optimistic about the future growth. As we've said in our public presentations, you know, our goal is to be, you know, at 20 airports soon and hopefully at 50 airports in the near future. So there's a lot of still low-hanging fruit out there for us to focus on. This whole SPAC cycle, which I, you know, keep watching from the distance, I think that the only day for us going public has been the right decision and has been a good fit. And for our business model, I think it's going to work out for us, but it's not for everybody. So, you know, I think companies that have not gone public yet, they got to be very careful in terms of how they spend their money and going public. What is it that they do for them besides raising the capital? You know, for us, it has also helped us attract talent into the company, because every employee is a shareholder, even all the way to the lines people. And it has aligned, you know, the incentives of the employees to be aligned with that of our shareholders. So I've become the banker. I'll end with this note. The banker that for 25 years told people, don't go public, don't go public. Now have been, having gone through the process as an issuer, I've become more, optimistic about being a public company in that setting. I try to attend events on New York Stock Exchange where we are listed, New York Stock Exchange American. And so we very much, you know, are now much more optimistic in terms of the benefits of public markets to companies.